Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the Haunted Collection. It's the month of October, Halloween month. My top favorite months of the year, as you can imagine, because I love a good ghost story. I love scary movies. I love dressing up on Halloween night to pass out the candy to the children. It's just a really fun time to have, and it's the beginning of the fall season, which is even more awesome. We're that much closer to Thanksgiving, to Christmas, and I just really love it. So tonight, in the spirit of Halloween, I'm going to bring you some great stories tonight. We've got monsters, we've got witches, and we've got zombies. Monsters and witches and zombies, oh my. Monsters and witches and zombies, oh my. But before I start the stories, let me once again tell you that just a week from tomorrow starts the Crypticon at the Wharf in Orange Beach, Alabama. If you're in that area, please plan to stop by and see us. You can go to abnormalalabama.com and buy tickets. I will be there with my books, and I'll be signing pictures, taking photos if you want. There will be some haunted dolls on display, including two dolls that we caught moving on camera. If you haven't yet, go check out my YouTube channel, My Haunted Dolls, Kevin Kane. It's out there, and you can watch the footage of the dolls moving and the spirit box session that I did with them a few nights later. So be sure to check that out. Be sure to check out my website, myhaunteddolls.com. You can purchase my books, purchase a photo, or find the links to my YouTube channel and my other media. Be sure to check it out. I do have a new book out. I'm so excited. Crimson, The Blood Painting is out now. Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble, and all of the fine online book retailers. Be sure to check that out, or you can buy a copy directly from me at myhaunteddolls.com. So be sure to check that out. Crimson, The Blood Painting. It's all about this cursed haunted painting from Salem and the chaos and murder that follows everywhere it goes. So be sure to check that out. And now let's get down to business with our stories tonight, because I've got an awesome lineup for you. And without further ado, let's get it started. First up, the Philadelphia Blob. You may have heard of the movie The Blob. It was a classic Monster Jam released in 1958, and it starred world-famous actor Steve McQueen in his first major role. His leading lady was Anita Corsault, the future Miss Crump from The Andy Griffith Show. At that time, she was just starting out, and so was Steve. The movie revolved around a town menaced by an unknown creature that arrives from space in a tiny meteorite. The meteor hits the ground in the nearby woods and is discovered by a lonely hermit who lives in a nearby shack. The hermit sees the crash and investigates to find the tiny object in a crater. Poking it with a stick, he caused it to break open, and a small jelly-like mass was revealed. The blob attaches itself to the stick while the old man is poking it. It slides onto his arm and begins to exhume him. From there, the tiny blob begins a trail of destruction through the town, absorbing one town person after another, and with each victim growing larger and larger until it is gigantic in size and its blood red from its victims. A pretty horrifying movie if you think about when it came out, 1958. The movie had a sequel in the 70s, and then a remake followed in the 1980s, and even now, there's a new movie, a reimagining, in the works. But, with all of this, did you know that this slimy ball of evil was actually based on a real incident? Yes, you heard me correctly. It was a fall evening in the mid-September of 1950, and a patrol car with two veteran officers, Joe Keenan and John Collins, were inside, cruising along a county road in the woods outside of Philadelphia. As they traveled the winding road through the darkness and the pine trees, the officers both spotted something mysterious in the night sky above their windshield. A large object was floating slowly and silently down toward the earth. Both officers described the object as looking like a parachute. Believing someone was parachuting in an area where such an activity was not allowed, they decided to locate the landing spot and check it out, and talk to the person to let him know he was not supposed to do that. As the object, or parachute as they thought, disappeared into the trees, the officer made it to the part of the road closest to the location where it landed. Parking their car on the side of the road, they proceeded with flashlights in hand, both on foot, into the woods, headed in the direction of what they still believed was a parachutist. When they reached the area, the officers were shocked to find not a parachute, not even a human being, but laying across the forest floor before them was what they later described as a purple jelly that was approximately 6 feet in diameter and about a foot high in the middle. The mass was pulsating, and when they turned off their flashlights, the jelly seemed to glow all around, as if it was made of a bioluminescent material, glowing in the dark, illuminating the trees above them. Keenan and Collins called immediately for backup to help, for they did not know what this thing was or what it might do. Two more cops showed up shortly after to witness the wonder of the blob-like creature. One of the new arrivals, Sergeant Cook, discussed with the rest of the group on whether or not one of them should perhaps try to touch the substance and see if they could find out what it was, for it appeared to be a solid mass, but they weren't sure if it was actually a living creature or not. Boy, were they bold to even think about such a suggestion. But they drew straws to pick which one of them amongst them might take that step, and of course Sergeant Cook, the one who came up with the idea, drew the shortest straw. He reached down and picked up a handful of the jelly mass. When he lifted his hand up to look, the jelly mass instantly broke apart in his hand, with tiny globules sticking to his skin. Ugh. Within seconds, the tiny globules evaporated, and he was left with what he described as an odorless scum on his hand. After 30 minutes of this thing lying on the forest floor, the entire blob evaporated into the dirt. When interviewed separately about the incident later on, all four officers told the same story and described the same creature perfectly. Each man agreed that the blob they'd seen was indeed a living organism. But what had it really been? A space creature coming to Earth to check out our planet, only to find itself evaporated in our atmosphere? Was it some sort of man-made thing released into the atmosphere accidentally by some nearby lab? Perhaps it was some sort of space garbage that found its way down to our planet's surface. Maybe some form of pollution. Whatever it was, it made for a chilling story, and no one to this day has ever been able to identify it or determine its origin. Several years after the incident, movie producer Jack Harris was looking for a new kind of monster movie. During the late 50s, the B-monster movies were a success at the box office, with creatures like giant spiders, giant ants, giant grasshoppers even, and space aliens alike. So he asked his friend Irvine H. Milgate to come up with some ideas. The producer, Mr. Harris, specifically requested that the monster in his movie be one that had never been done before and was almost indestructible. Well, Mr. Milgate remembered the article he read back in 1950 about the Philadelphia incident with the police officers and the strange jelly-like creature they'd witnessed. And he decided that this indeed would make for an outstanding horror story. And thus, a movie monster was born. The Blob. And there you have it. Even I didn't know that that movie was based on a real incident until a few years ago. And I tell you, it makes you wonder what else might drop out of the sky when you least expect it. And now we move to our second story. This one is a glorious, very spooky story, allegedly a true story about a witch. I give you The Witch of Hinds Road. And if you live in the Gadsden area of Alabama, you may be familiar with this. If not, be prepared for a surprise, because this is a really scary story. The Witch of Hinds Road. The witch was said to have lived in a tiny shack back in the woods off Hinds Road. Hinds is a very hard to get to road, but when you do, you feel like you're in a different world once you walk or drive down it. And it's been told that this witch was an old mystic that went by the name Torbit, who sold her soul to the devil. Around the turn of the 19th century was her reign, and what a reign it was indeed. For 20 years, 20 long years, she terrorized the citizens of Gadsden, and especially their children. Mainly those foolish enough to venture up to Hinds Road in search of her. It is said that she would kill them and drink and bathe in their blood to keep her young and decorate the outside of her shack with their bones. For years, children went missing in that area, and for years, the adults were far too afraid to venture up to Hinds Road to call out the witch. That is, until about 1939, when the current mayor of that time said enough was enough, and he sent a mob up to get her. When the mob got there, what they found turned their hair white and drained all blood from their faces. First, they found a pond, or what would have been a pond, had it not been completely filled with blood and body parts. Some were still whole bodies of children, children of different ages. When the people in the mob were able to get their bearings back and get their stomachs turned around, they ventured further up the winding dirt road. On the side of the road, they saw a cave that had the foulest of stenches coming forward. One of the men, a brave soul, went in. After only a few moments, he let out a spine-shattering scream and came out stark white. The man never spoke of what he saw. As a matter of fact, he never spoke again after that. Seeing his condition, no one else was brave enough to go in. A few of the people were left with some nerves, and they formed a small band which went on to the cabin where they found the witch at her front door. They were amazed because they'd heard she was an old, wrinkled woman. What they found was a young, beautiful lady with long black hair and emerald eyes, naked and covered in blood. They asked her, "Are you the one that they call the witch? Are you Torbit?" "Yes, it is I," she replied. And without hesitation, the mob threw their flaming torches on her and her den of death. They watched as she burned and the cabin turned to ash. During all of this, as it went on, they say down in the city, everyone could hear her cackling laughter coming out of the woods and see the white hot flames and smoke rising from the area of the forest. But many people believe that Torbett never left. Here are some of the claims that still exist today. They say you can still see her ghostly cabin in the woods when the moon is full and the light shines down on the abandoned lot that to this day still has nothing growing in that area. No grass even will grow in that area. Some have even seen her dancing, her spirit dancing, still young and beautiful, covered in blood and laughing, cackling, casting her spells on any child that is brave enough to come close to her area. The pond is now full of water and looks quite beautiful, but it is said that you can still see orbs of light dancing across the water. It is said that those orbs of light are the spirit of the children that were never put to rest on hallowed ground. They are lost between this world and the next because of the tragedy. Sometimes Torbett herself will make an appearance in the woods across the pond at the water's edge, dipping her hands down in the pond water and pouring it over herself as if she were still dousing herself with a blood fountain of youth. The cave still has a foul stench coming from it. Some who have ventured there today say it is still true, but no one will go too far inside it for fear of what they might find. Those who do go will not tell of what they see. There is the story of one young woman who went back far enough to see what she could find, but what she found terrified her and gave her nightmares. A creature resembling a skinned dog and smelling of rotting flesh was there, growling at her with eyes blazing. Needless to say, she made a hasty retreat from that cave. It is also said that people have seen activity of devil worshippers around that area, because knowing the history, they feel that it is the best place to practice their witchcraft. It is their stomping ground. And it is said if you go up there after dark, you just might be beaten or killed by this group of people. I, for one, have never been in this area, but I'm not sure I'd want to venture there after dark. But if you're brave enough to venture up Hines Road and find the area, just be sure to know you might not come back, at least not as a whole person. And that was the Witch of Hines Road. Now for our final story of this episode, a nice creepy story of the undead. This story is known as The Deadly Dinner. William Seabrook was an American writer. He spent a lot of time on the island of Haiti and became fascinated by the practice of voodoo and the tales of zombies that roamed the land, the walking dead. Seabrook told a lot of strange stories about Haiti, and this is one of them. It's not quite a ghost story, but by the end of it, you just might agree that it's close enough. The story involves a young girl named Camille. Her family, which had once been wealthy, had fallen on hard times. But Camille was a beautiful girl. Everyone in her family hoped that she would marry a wealthy man. Because of her beauty and charm, she quickly became one of the most popular girls in Port-au-Prince society. Port-au-Prince, if you're not familiar, is Haiti's largest city. As her family expected, she soon attracted the attention of a wealthy man. His name was Mathieu Tassel. He owned a large and prosperous coffee plantation in the mountains. Tassel was a rather mysterious fellow. He had been born quite poor, but made a lot of money very quickly. He stayed on his plantation most of the time, and didn't spend much time in Port-au-Prince society. There were rumors about him, rumors that he was somehow mixed up with magic, the magic of the darkest kind. But no one knew anything for sure. Tassel didn't really have a bad reputation, so when he told Camille's family that he wished to marry her, they were delighted. Camille herself was not displeased. True, he was a good deal older than she was, but he was still a handsome-looking man and a very vigorous one. Though he had little in the way of formal education, he was still a very intelligent man. The only thing Camille regretted about marrying Tassel was that she would have to go off and live on his plantation. She knew that she would miss the social life she was adjusted to, but she also knew she would be the mistress of a fine, large house. For a few months, life seemed to go well for Camille. She lived on Tassel's plantation, but she also came down to Port-au-Prince regularly for parties. She was able to lend her father some money, and she even had money to send her younger brother who was away at school. Slowly, however, Camille seemed to change. No one could quite be sure what was different. Camille never complained. She never said a word against her husband, yet she looked and acted as if she were unhappy. The once lively and talkative girl had now become sad and quiet. Her family tried to talk to her, but she kept saying that everything was fine and that she was perfectly happy. Finally, she did speak frankly to her mother. It was not a real complaint against Tassel, you see. He was as kind and considerate to her as he always had been, but more and more he seemed to have something else on his mind. Then there were nights when he would ride off early in the evening and not return until dawn. He never explained where he was going, and Camille never asked. It was all very strange, and it worried and frightened her. That was why she seemed so sad. Her mother asked Camille if she thought Tassel was seeing another woman. Camille said she was quite sure he was not. Her mother then said that perhaps he was having business troubles. Men often acted strangely when they had business troubles, so perhaps that was it. Her mother told Camille that she should not worry, that things would soon come right again. And Camille agreed that they probably would. Their first wedding anniversary was coming up, and Camille felt sure that her husband would mark the occasion in some special way. But he said nothing about it. Early in the evening, he rode off. Camille was heartbroken. She went to bed and cried herself to sleep. Near midnight, she was awakened. Her husband was standing by her bedside, holding a lamp. He was not dressed in his riding clothes. He was dressed in formal evening clothes, as if he were going to a fancy party. "Put on your wedding dress and make yourself pretty," he said. "We are going to a party." Though still half asleep, Camille was delighted. She thought that her husband had planned an anniversary surprise for her after all. She assumed her husband was taking her to some late supper dance at a seaside club. Later, after she dressed and she joined him on the veranda, she asked, "Where's the car?"
"Oh, we don't need a car," he replied. "The party is to be here."
He pointed to one of the outbuildings. It was one that he often used as his office. From the outbuilding came the soft flickering of candlelight. Tassel took Camille by the hand and led her to the building. The inside had been decorated like a fancy dining room. In the center of the room was an elegantly set table,
and around the table sat four men in evening clothes. There were also two empty chairs. The men did not get up when Tousel and Camille entered. Instead, they sat slumped in their chairs, facing forward. They had wine glasses in front of them, and Camille assumed that they had already had too much to drink and were probably feeling the effects of the wine. Tousel led his wife to an empty chair and stood by the other one when he began to speak in a strange and confused way. "I beg you, forgive my guests. They may seem rude, but it is a long time since they tasted wine. A long time since they sat at a table. But shortly they will drink with you. They will raise their arms as I raise mine. They will clink glasses with you. They will arise. They will dance with you." A feeling of horror crept over Camille. She looked at one of the guests. His fingers were rigidly clasped around the stem of a wine glass. He was not just drunk. She took a candle and held it close to his face. This man was dead. She was sitting at a table with four propped-up corpses. She screamed and rushed for the door. Tousel tried to stop her, but she was much too fast for him. The next morning, women in a nearby village found her in the marketplace. She was unconscious. When she was revived, she was completely hysterical. She told her story in a confused way. At first, no one believed her. They went to Tousel's plantation and found the little building. Inside, it was all set up for a formal dinner, just as Camille had described it. But the four guests were gone. So was Mathau Tousel. He was never again seen on his plantation, or indeed anywhere else in Haiti. It was rumored that he had fled to some other island, but no one was for sure that that is what happened. The police did not try to chase him, for what could he be charged with? Camille never recovered from her experience. She finally became totally insane and spent the rest of her days in a hospital. Had she always been insane? Had the whole story just been the fantasy of her mind? And if that were the case, why did Tousel run away? And who set up the dinner table, and why? If the story was true, what had Tousel been planning? What would have happened to Camille had she not escaped? William Seabrook says he asked that question many times, but he never got a convincing answer. He never got a convincing theory. Most people would just shrug their shoulders. But perhaps it is best that we don't know. Keeping in the same tune, Seabrook told an even stranger story. It was about a magician named Ty Joseph. This magician had created a large number of zombies from corpses he had stolen. He used his magical powers to make the corpses move, and then he hired them out to work in the sugarcane fields. Naturally, Ty Joseph collected all their wages. One day, Ty had to go off for a few days, so he left his wife in charge of the zombies. He told her that they were on no account to be given any salt. You see, as soon as a zombie tastes salt, or at least it's believed, the zombie will become conscious again. Then it will realize that it is a walking corpse. Joseph was gone longer than expected. His wife was bored, just sitting around watching the zombies. There was a carnival in a nearby village. She wanted to go and hear the music and see all the people in their costumes, but she knew she could not leave the zombies unattended. So, she decided to take them along. She knew that all zombies had come from a distant village. Therefore, there was no chance of any of the zombies being recognized by relatives in her town who had recently buried them, because they were not from there. The wife, followed by a line of silent, obedient zombies, went down to the village for the carnival. She sat them down in the town square, and all the gaily costumed carnival goers swirled around them, but the expression of the zombies never changed. Now, this wife, was not a hard-hearted person, so she was distressed to see that the zombies were not enjoying themselves. She wanted to do something to cheer them up. A woman came by selling candy made from sugar cane and nuts. She thought that it would do no harm to give some candy to the zombies. What she did not know was that the nuts had been well salted. As soon as the zombies began to eat the candy and tasted the salt, they changed. They began uttering horrible cries. Oh! Then they got up and they staggered straight out of the marketplace and out of town. They were heading directly toward the village and the graveyard from which their bodies had been stolen. As the zombies passed through their hometown, many of the villagers recognized their dead relatives, and they guessed what must have happened to them. The people tried to speak to them, but the zombies would not answer. They would not even turn their heads. They went directly to the graveyard. Then each zombie threw himself on the grave from which he had been stolen. Some of them tried to dig their way back into the ground with their rotting, bony fingers. But finally, they all collapsed, completely lifeless again. Then their relatives tearfully restored the bodies to their proper graves. If you ever plan a trip to Haiti, keep a listen for those famous zombie stories that still roam the land there. For it's still a very superstitious place, and some still believe in those zombies that walk the earth. If you see someone slumped over, not reacting, looking like they're in a trance, be careful, because you might have just come across a zombie. I hope you enjoyed these wonderful stories, and I hope you're going to have a happy Halloween, because Halloween is just 2 weeks from tonight, and I'm looking forward to it. I've got my pumpkins out, I've got my jack-o'-lanterns glowing. In fact, one of my jack-o'-lanterns is the replica of the jack-o'-lantern you see at the beginning of Halloween 2, the 1981 horror classic. So be sure to have a great time. Enjoy the rest of your October month. I will see you again before Halloween. I plan another show, so tune back in to hear me share some more spine-chilling tales of the supernatural. Until then, happy hauntings!